Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Meet the Press, the longest running program on television, is now celebrating its 70th anniversary. Holy cow. And here's an example of how old it is. Martin Luther King on Meet the Press, March 28th, 1965, just after the five-day march from Selma to Montgomery. The moderator is Lawrence Spivak asking about Harry Truman. Harry Truman. This is, by the way, I'm not sure if we have the right clip queued up, but I think this is Harry Truman criticizing the march.
Dr. King, former President Truman, was quoted by the AP as saying that the march from Selma, and this was his word, was silly and can't accomplish a darn thing except to attract attention. Now, there have been two murders, many beatings, and a federal expenditure for troops of about $300,000. Would you say that what the march accomplished was worth that cost?
Well, first, I would say that the march was not silly at all. I would think that the march did more to dramatize the indignities and the injustices that Negro people continue to face in the state of Alabama and many other sections of the South more than anything else. I think it was the most powerful and dramatic civil rights protest that has ever taken place in the South, and I think it well justified the cost that we put in it.
How about that? Martin Luther King on Meet the Press in 1965 on being criticized for the Selma to Montgomery march by Harry Truman. Now we're very happy to have back with us the host of Meet the Press, Chuck Todd, and with him as they mark the 70th anniversary of the longest running show on television, the executive producer of Meet the Press, John Reese. Chuck, welcome back. John, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks so much.
And we'll talk about current news as well. Chuck, what were you thinking as you heard that clip?
Well, it's the best part of being attached to Meet the Press is just the fact that the show itself takes you through the history of this country, and in some ways it's a reminder that some of these issues that we're struggling with now, we've been struggling with pretty much the entire history of the show.
Yeah, and here's another example of that. We're going to play one more 40-second clip from Martin Luther King on Meet the Press in 1965. And right to your point, Chuck, listen to how contemporary this sounds. Sadly, again, Meet the Press moderator Lawrence Spivak to Dr. King.
Dr. King, I think the demonstration was largely to get your voting rights bill through. Was it necessary for that purpose? Aren't you going to get that bill? And wouldn't you have gotten it whether or not you marched?
Well, the demonstration was certainly for the voting rights bill. However, we must recognize that there are other very tragic conditions existing in the state of Alabama which are as humiliating, as degrading, and as unjust as the denial of the right to vote, namely police brutality.
And John Reese, we're still talking about voting rights and police brutality all these years later. Kind of depressing.
That's exactly what I was thinking listening to that. We're talking about exactly that. Voting rights, things haven't changed nearly as much as we'd like. Sometimes you look back at something from 1965 and think, boy, things have changed so much. But that clip tells you that that may not be the case.
Interesting, though, to hear King in conversation. The clips that survive are usually his soaring oratory at speeches, Chuck. So to go back and hear him in a television interview in this quiet studio setting, I think it's a first for a lot of listeners.
It is. I mean, look, there's so many interesting firsts. I mean, people, do you realize that one of the few English language interviews Fidel Castro gave? To Meet the Press. If you want to hear Fidel Castro speak English, one of the few places that took place was in a Meet the Press interview. No, I mean, look, that's that was the whole point of the show when Martha Roundtree, I mean, that was the whole idea of it, which was get these folks answering questions from reporters, because at the time on television, because at the time that wasn't happening very often, and there wasn't a lot of public, the public didn't see how the reporters and the powerful interacted. And in many ways, that Meet the Press helped sort of set the table to make this a reminder that this is among the functions of what journalists need to do, which is hold these elected leaders or these powerful leaders to account, but also surface uncomfortable issues.
You mentioned Martha Roundtree. John, Meet the Press had a woman moderator in those early days in the 1950s, right?
How about that? Well, we don't have a woman moderator right now, but I will say that our staff is largely female.
I can hear the women groaning out there. at that.
I hear that too. But look, there's a reason that Chuck is the moderator of Meet the Press. This show was made for Chuck, we have a brand about American politics that I think Chuck brought to the show that perhaps you couldn't have gotten with any other moderator, male or female.
Right. Well, I don't mean this as an attack on Chuck, not at all. But there have been no women moderators, I don't think, in a staff position since. And the other Sunday shows, too, overwhelmingly male.
I mean, in fairness, Brian, Leslie Stahl, I think, was at Face the Nation for quite some time. And Cokie Roberts, of course, shared
as a panelist.
Moderating.
Oh, she did. That's true.
Our own. Cokie,
yes.
So, look, there's no doubt. I mean, I can tell you this. You'll never see an all-male panel. If you see a majority of one gender ever on our roundtables, it's women, not men.
There's no question on – sorry, go ahead, Chuck.
No. This to me is extraordinarily important that we have to have more – a more diverse set of opinions that are both gender, geography, ethnicity, ideology, and that's the puzzle I'm always trying to put together. But I do think, it is not difficult to
not easy
to make sure the panel always reflects the population, the country on gender.
Yes.
When you look at the history of our panelists, as we have done over the last few weeks, it was largely male, and I know that over the last 3 years, since Chuck has been the moderator, without question, a majority of our panelists have been female.
Another clip from history, this one you sent us. It's JFK, and I think this has a production music bed under it, but it's JFK running for president in 1960, asked about his Catholicism.
You, as a Roman Catholic, might suffer some difficulty as a candidate for president, as Alfred E. Smith did, but that as vice president, you would add a great deal to the ticket.
Well, Mr. Wilson, I would be extremely sorry if that if they said we won't take Kennedy because he's a Catholic, but we want him because he's a Catholic for vice president. If we make the determination, both of those determinations on the grounds of my religion, regardless of any other factors, I would think that the Democratic Party would not deserve to be successful. Because you would be giving an office to a candidate who potentially could be the president in either case, and whose only claim under those conditions would be that he happened to go to church on Sunday to the Catholic Church. I must say I would consider that at a most crucial time in the life of this country to be a disastrous way of picking a ticket.
Pretty amazing piece of history right there. John Reese, why'd you pull that as an example?
Well, look, we were looking for all kinds of different examples and things that that viewers would watch and think, my gosh, how things have changed. One of the clips that we had was Geraldine Ferraro in 1984, when she was the VP nominee for the Democrats, being asked, can you push the nuclear button? And I'm guessing I heard that back then and didn't think anything of the question. And we listened to it this time, and we all groaned because we understand that what informed that question really was, can a woman push the nuclear button?
And it reminds me, hearing that Kennedy clip, that we live in a time now of the ascendancy of Roy Moore, who doesn't think Congressman Keith Ellison should be allowed to serve in Congress because he's Muslim, and Mike Pence, who says, I'm a Christian first, a conservative second, a Republican third. Chuck, imagine if John F. Kennedy had said, I'm a Catholic first, the way Mike Pence does now in 1960.
Well, I could imagine it, and you know what he'd be known as? A former senator from Massachusetts.
Exactly.
And sadly,
so,
you know, had he done that, it would have been politically problematic for him. But you know what I was thinking about in that clip? It's funny you bring up Keith Ellison. It's not beyond the realm to me that Keith Ellison may decide himself to run for president someday, and suddenly, he gets the same set of questions, and if it's on him or whoever. You know, it's inevitable in this country that somebody who is Muslim will run for president. We're going to see the same set of questions for that person, probably in the public as John Kennedy had to deal with.
I don't know. Twitter tells me we just had our first Muslim president for the last 8 years. I'm kidding. but it is amazing in the polls how many Republicans seem to actually believe, I don't know if either of you know any numbers on this, I didn't know this was going to come up, so I didn't look it up, but what percentage of Republicans during the Obama administration actually believed that he was Muslim?
Well, it was interesting how we used to poll that question. We never, I used to think some of the ways that people polled that question was they were trying hard to get an answer that they wanted to shock people with, but we did it this way. We said, you know, we just asked an open-ended question. We would ask, what is the president's faith? And you would get a raw somewhere between 15 and 20% voluntarily saying Muslim. And it would be all coming from somebody who also identified on the right side with conservative ideology. So there certainly was this that sits out there that it was truly believe. I always thought that about half of the right was just trolling him, if you will, didn't really believe it, but thought it was good politics. But there's another half, that 15 to 20% overall, who really believed it.
Listeners, our guests are the host of Meet the Press, Chuck Todd, and the executive producer of Meet the Press, John Reese, as they mark the 70th anniversary of the longest running program on television. And we're going to talk about some contemporary news here and let Chuck put on his political analyst hat and then come back to some more Meet the Press history at the end. And listeners, we can take your phone calls either on Meet the Press then, now, or tomorrow, or on Things in the News, 212-433-WNYC. Obviously, Things in National Politics, 212-433-9692. Chuck, I went into Tuesday thinking the elections were not a bellwether for 2018, but then the Democratic victory in Virginia and elsewhere was so decisive that I started to think maybe it is. What's the evidence telling you?
Yeah, no, there's definitely something happened on there with Democratic turnout, right? We've polling had shown there had been small evidence all year long that there was an extra energy on the left. But the question was it ever going to actually play itself out to win an election, right? They came close but failed in Georgia. They came close but failed in about two or three other congressional seats. And so there was this sort of hanging out there. Is this energy going to translate into something? Oh, boy, did it. Look, the fact of the matter is you saw turnout. You saw a turnout in Northern Virginia that looked more like a presidential level turnout, and you saw more first time candidates winning office than we've seen in a long time across the country. All of them happen to be Democrats, so there's definitely something out there. They're getting candidates to run, and their voters are going to the polls. So Donald Trump has energized a certain segment of the electorate, both on the base left. And then I think if you look at Virginia, they've got to realize they've got a suburban problem. And if you extrapolate if you assume the coalition that Ralph Northam put together, which includes a lot, basically college-educated whites, in as well as sort of the normal Democratic coalition, that is a recipe for Democrats to pick up 25 to 30 House seats.
And
it would all be in suburban America. Think in the places around Atlanta, Phoenix, Dallas, and it's really the Sun Belt. I really think the Sun Belt is going to be the 2018 battleground from Arizona to Florida.
25-30 is a really,
that's what you'll see.
Really big number. That would give the Democrats a majority in the House, wouldn't it?
It would. I think right now they've got a course correct here, because right now they're on a trajectory. Look, big events can happen outside of events. They're on a trajectory here where you could say their Republicans are now the underdogs to hold the House. That doesn't mean they'll lose the Senate. In fact, you could make a case, because of our urban-rural polarization combined with the quirkiness of what states are up this cycle in the U.S. Senate, that Republicans could actually gain a Senate seat and lose control of the House in the same election night.
We had David Wasserman from the Cook Political Report on MTP Daily yesterday, and he had said, even on Tuesday night, that it's hard to deny that the Democrats aren't at least slight favorites to win the House. Hmm. But on the show yesterday, he pointed out that if you sort of took the overlay of Virginia and put it on over the Senate, you actually could make a pretty good argument that the Republicans could gain a seat or two. One of the things, if you sort of get into the details of what happened in Virginia, the blue counties got bluer and the red counties got redder. And that may be very helpful to Democrats in states like Virginia with large suburban populations. It may be less helpful in states like Ohio, where there are more older, white, blue-collar workers.
Let's take a phone call. Griffin, Chuck, go ahead, real briefly.
No, it's interesting. I had talked to a bunch of Republican consultants yesterday, just taking their temperature, and a couple of them were saying, oh, boy, we're thankful we have no senators up in places like Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, in swing states. They're just relieved that the 10 Senate seats that they have up, most of them are in more rural states.
Griffin in New Canaan, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to address the issue of blue counties getting bluer and red counties getting redder. I think that perhaps it's a consequence of the identity politics that we're participating in, just like Mike Pence, from that earlier quote that you brought up, did. He said that I'm a Christian first. Well, you know, both sides of the political spectrum are guilty of these identity politics. And I think that it is causing a more stratification and more division among our politically minded counties, and a division between all of them.
Griffin, thank you very much for that. So on that point, Chuck, did you see the Stanley Greenberg Democratic pollster article that said Ralph Northam, the Democratic candidate for governor in Virginia, was running just like Hillary Clinton did last year, not enough on economy, too much on identity politics, and that he would lose, but he won decisively? So I wonder how this informs the so-called identity politics versus run on the economy debate within the Democratic Party.
Well, look, the fact of the matter is everybody is correct here, and I want to commend the caller. I completely agree. Our politics have become so tribal, and that is it is exasperating this divide. And the problem is the paid political consultants have realized this is a very effective way to get out the vote. It's a very effective way to campaign if you sort of segment the electorate, almost like you were trying to, sell Coca-Cola. And unfortunately, I think that it has contributed to this sense that we don't look for a way what are the four common issues that bind this coalition together, right? We don't have politicians that try to do that right now, and I think that is an unhelpful, that is only making the divide worse. But to Stanley Greenberg's point, the fact of the matter is, I do believe that in 2018 in a midterm, Democrats don't need a message. They could just simply run a not Trump.
Really?
Look, Ralph Northam won by 10 points.
Yeah.
It still doesn't mean he answered the immigration question. It still doesn't mean he figured out the crime question. It still doesn't mean he figured out how to run on the economy. And oh, by the way, Ralph Northam did just as badly as Hillary Clinton did in rural parts of Virginia. He's the first Democratic governor to win and not carry any part of the state that is within 100 miles of the Tennessee border. And, you know, people forget Virginia does stretch quite a long way. But the point is, I do think people need to heed Stan Greenberg's warning, not for 2018, but for 2020. You can win a midterm election not having a message. He's simply not being the other guy if you're the party out of power. The Republicans did it very well in 2010. But what happened in 2012 when they suddenly had to bring it all together? They came up short. So I do think Democrats shouldn't look at the Northam victory and say, ah, boy, the recipe's there. Just be not Trump, and that'll get you to the White House in 2020. That I don't agree with. I think they can win back control of Congress that way. That is enough. But that isn't how you win the presidency.
Stan Greenberg really wasn't the only one. He wasn't alone in predicting Gillespie would win. There were a lot of people, but I think the one thing that nobody anticipated was that the Democrats would have an 11-point advantage in turnout. It was 41-30, and I don't know that you can replicate that across the country.
Nina in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Nina.
Hi, good morning. Thanks so much for taking my call. I don't think it's a particularly original question, but I just want to bring it up again, and I'd love to get anyone's take on it. I'm wondering about responsible reporting in light of all of these mass shootings. And I'm just concerned when I turn on the TV or look at the front page of the paper that we're continuing to, of course, try to understand the person who's done it, what led them to it. You know, we have to learn from it so that it doesn't happen again. But we are giving people who are, at the very least, mentally ill, a huge platform, and it concerns me that this is just perpetuating the cycle of it continuing by the attention that we give to the person. They've achieved their goal.
Nina,
right?
What would you do? Have you thought this through? Have you said, okay, now I'm the executive producer. Am I not going to cover the news conference that explains more of the details of how the shooting was done or how the guy in this particular Texas case was shot himself by a Good Samaritan?
No, of course it needs to be.
So what would you not do?
Because how do you find that balance of covering the story responsibly while not turning the killer into
a celebrity?
A celebrity, which is.
And some people do it for the fame. So I'll give you this as an executive producer question, John Reese.
Mm-hmm. Well, look, this is something we've really struggled with. When after Las Vegas, we had a pretty vigorous debate on the staff about whether or not we wanted the show to focus on the gun debate.
And John, dirty little secret: the caller and I were pretty much in sync.
Chuck was largely leading the crowd, saying the faction saying, "Why do this again? It all looks the same." I was on the other side, saying this is the story people were talking about. In the end, we did it, and you know what? It felt like every other show we had ever done on gun control or on the gun debate. And at the beginning of this week, we were looking at each other again, saying, "Are we going to do this again?" And my hunch is the answer, even without what happened in Virginia, would have been no, because I'm not sure what we could do this Sunday that would be any different from what we did a few weeks ago or what we have seen on Meet the Press or other Sunday shows actually for years.
The other side of that argument, though, Chuck, would be that it then lets the gun issue languish in complacency because we don't want to give attention to the shooter.
No, look, I'll be honest. I am more concerned about giving attention almost to the – I was uncomfortable with the saturation coverage of what happened in New York City with the terrorist attack. And I know we don't call domestic the international terrorism versus the domestic terrorism that we've seen both in Las Vegas and down in Texas. But I do worry about that. I mean, especially when you have an ISIS inspired attack. All they're looking for is the media attention. They want us to panic, and you know, you give them more attention for a small thing, a small accomplishment in their minds, and it does, I think, only serve to reinforce what they're trying to do, which is instill terror into the country, and that is something I think. Look, this is not easy decisions. I mean, I sit here because I do think, you know. People can get all the information they want anywhere. It's not up to us. You know, we're not the only ones controlling the flow of this information. But I do think how we cover these mass shootings, how we cover these terrorist attacks, we have to be more mindful of how this collectively looks and how this collectively impacts the psyche of perhaps the next terrorist or be him international or domestic.
Getting back to Virginia for a minute and what it means for the blue wave, we talked about gender in the media earlier. How about gender in the blue wave? Women, not just as candidates, taking 11 seats. For people who haven't heard this stat yet, women took 11 seats from Republican men in the Virginia House of Delegates on Tuesday, but also as leading the resistance from the Women's March on day two of the administration to really leading Tuesday's blue wave. Chuck, how much are you seeing the power of women expressing itself in Tuesday's results?
So, you know, my first election year that I covered as a reporter was 1992. That was the so-called Year of the Woman.
After Anita
Hill. And you had women Senate nominees, two of them in California. Geraldine Ferraro was running at that time in New York. So that was part of the nationalization of this. You had a woman nominee in Pennsylvania against Arlen Specter. Patty Murray, she got elected that year. And So I've seen fits and starts of this, and I can't believe I'm about to say this, Brian, but it appears that Donald Trump is going to do more for the advancement of women in politics than any president in our lifetime, than any political leader of our lifetime. Now, it's not necessarily that he's inspiring it, but I think his election, how he got elected, who he defeated. You know, throw in the Harvey Weinstein stuff, which then I think rekindles the backs of Hollywood comments from the president. There is a galvanization. I have seen it. You've seen it in the number of women running for office. I've seen it in conversations with women in my own life. I've seen it both anecdotal. You see it in the polls. If Democrats win back Congress, it is going to be not just women candidates, but women voters. I mean, the gender gap, I believe it was 22 points.
61-39. I happen to be looking at the exit poll right now.
It is just absolutely, it's growing. Look, there's been a gender gap in American politics between the two parties for quite some time, but Donald Trump is creating a gap that may be unwinnable at some point for a Republican. They cannot keep having a gender gap this and expect to win elections.
So do you think, Chuck, that we're going to see more Republicans running explicitly away from Trump as immoral and incompetent, more Bob Corkers and more Jeff Flakes, to be precise?
Mm-hmm. I think it depends where you are. In New Jersey, yes. In Pennsylvania, New York State, perhaps.
Kim Gordano refused to do it. The Nassau County and Westchester County executive Republicans refused to do it,
right. And
they all lost.
Well,
I don't know if that's why they lost.
You know, Brian, it was interesting. I talked to a Republican pollster, and I said, if you knew going in to Virginia that the Democrats were going to have an 11-point advantage, would you have changed your, you know, would you have focused your messaging more to woo the Northern Virginia, the suburban voter, rather than worrying about the Trump bait? And this person said to me, it's like, look, this is a pick your poison. He said, if Gillespie had then run a more Chamber of Commerce, you know, look at my tax cut proposal type of campaign to woo the Northern Virginian, the Trump base wouldn't have turned out in those numbers, and he'd have lost by 9 points. The point was, unfortunately, it is for many Republicans.
It's a box.
There's no threading the needle.
Yeah.
There is just picking your poison.
John Reese, executive producer of Meet the Press, I'll give you the last word. Since the occasion of your visit, the two of you, is the 70th anniversary of the longest running program on television. And obviously so much has changed in the media in all that time, including all the other Sunday shows. I think Meet the Press had the feel to itself originally. So how do you see the role of the show today compared to the early days?
I don't think that the role has changed that much, and I think Chuck has pointed out one of the things that we're most proud of as a show is not just what we do, but that at the start, Meet the Press was the only show like it on the air. Now we have lots of competitors, all of whom are run and moderated by terrific journalists. And I think while we're all competitors, I really have this sort of naive sense that in some ways we're all on the same side here.
John Reese is the executive producer of Meet the Press and Meet the Press Daily. Chuck Todd is the host. For those of you who don't know, Meet the Press isn't just a Sunday show. It's also Meet the Press Daily in the 5 o'clock hour on MSNBC, Monday through Friday. Thanks, both of you, for coming on. Congratulations on 70 years. Chuck, keep coming on with us from time to time. Our listeners like hearing from you.
I love it, Brian. Always good. I always get some great feedback. You've got a great listenership. Trust me, a very smart one.
Thanks so much. Thanks again to both of you.